This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, and my guest today is the number one best-selling author in the UK as of this recording right now. It's John Ronson, the author of The Castle, his latest book, which is called subtitled Adventures in a World of Unraveling Men. He's the author of The Psychopath Test. His books have been the base. He's written a couple movies as well as other books being used as the basis of movies like The Men Who Stare at Goats, etc. He was on the Reason interview a couple years ago for the second season of his wonderful podcast, Things Fell Apart, which has a new season coming out as well. That'll all be available. Look in the show notes for that. But right now, we're talking to John Castle. We're talking to John Ronson about his smash hit number one book, The Castle. John Ronson, thanks for talking to Reason.
Hi, very nice to see you again.
What does it feel like to have a book go to number one? Is this your first number one, or are you just used to that?
Actually, no. When the Men Who Stare at Goats movie came out, I rode that George Clooney wave to number one for 1 week.
Okay.
But that was 2009, and this is the second time. Yeah. The honest answer is, I was saying this to my wife, actually, that success always coincides with an unbelievably fucking difficult schedule.
Oh yeah.
So I always experience
that's
success.
Why I say no to success. Right. Like I need my downtime.
I definitely am feeling the success through a fog of tiredness is the answer.
Well, let's start with this the subtitle. And what we're going to talk about, The Castle and who owns the castle, et cetera, in a second. But Adventures in a World of Unraveling Men. What do you mean by unraveling men?
Well, I'm about to say, this is a story that crashed into my life unannounced. Yeah. Like, I had no preconceptions. Mm-hmm. In fact, can I quickly tell how the story begins? Because it's just an easier way to kind of ground it. And tell me if I'm telling this for too long. Stop me at any point.
I already stopped listening, but no, please.
Okay, I'm asleep, and I wake up, and there's a series of texts from my son. And the last text said, "We left. That was completely fucked.
Yeah.
We're safe now, or it's okay now." Mm-hmm. And I read all the other texts, and it turned out that him and three friends had been invited to a party being held by a stranger that one of them had met on Tinder. They turn up at the guy's house, and it is a massive castle.
In the kind of middle of nowhere in Connecticut.
Yeah. Well, on a semi-suburban street of otherwise ordinary modest homes. Oh. Just ranch house. Yeah. Fucking castle.
Right.
Ranch house. Yeah. Ostentatious, even by Gothic castle standards. So the gates open, and they cross the drawbridge and enter the grand banqueting hall to discover that there's no party. It's a trick. They've been lured there for other reasons. So the castle owner comes out. Again, tell me when you think that's a good cliffhanger, and I'll move on to your question. The castle owner comes out, and they said, "Sorry, where's the party?" And he said, "Oh, no, I've invited you here for another reason. I would like you all to take part in my reality show." So they said, "What's the name of your reality show?" He said, "It's 101 Princesses." Mm-hmm. They said, "What's the core concept?" He said, "I'm the king. I'm looking for my queen. I have 101 princesses to choose from." Then he said, "Go downstairs to my basement costume room to the women, put on princess costumes, and come back upstairs for filming."
Yeah.
So they went downstairs, put on princess costumes dutifully, came up. A videographer appeared. Filming began, but it became pretty clear that this wasn't an actual reality show.
And as you point out, the guys, it's kind of like saying, "Oh, well, we're going to get on Netflix, or we're going to do this," but it's all, seems kind of like a Baroque porn set.
Yeah. They were confident that it would end up on Netflix. But I doubt
maybe if there's a true crime show. We'll get to that later the person you're talking about is a guy named Chris Mark.
Yeah.
And
his great grand, he got his money because his great grandfather was a Gilded Age steel tycoon.
Yeah.
And it did make me smile that, like, the Mark dynasty's 100-year journey from steel manufacturing, the most tangible product imaginable, to a reality show that almost definitely won't end up on Netflix feels like a very American story.
And Mark, well, the great economist Joseph Schumpeter said that, it's three generations from work sleeves to work sleeves. So, Chris is, you know, still living off the juice that his great grandfather or whatever did.
But, yeah.
You know, his kids are going to have tougher and tougher time, including his daughter who was in the castle.
Right? Yeah, because I then went to the castle. I don't think she was there the night that Dol went, but they got kicked out after they refused to participate in 101 Princesses. And I, the minute they told me what had happened, went to the castle.
You were like, the only thing that would have been better is if your son had been murdered there, right? Then you would be number one in America as well as the UK. But just, we'll return to Chris Mark because his bizarre and sad story is the spine of the book. So he's the first unraveling man that we meet.
What does unraveling mean? Yeah, exactly. So with him, I thought, okay, here's a man who's trying to be Hugh Hefner at the worst moment in human history to be Hugh Hefner. He's a man out of time.
Right.
The type of man he is no longer in vogue. And so he's like lost and flailing around. Mm-hmm. I was lost and flailing around at the same time for completely different reasons. Yeah. I'd just got out of hospital. I had major surgery. Yeah. The nurse... I was in hospital twice. The first time was because I fell over while arguing with my mother over the telephone about whether or not she should go into a home.
Right.
I was for it. She was against
it. I think she won that argument.
At least
that round.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because I animated so, you know, I gesticulated so animatedly. I slipped on ice and toppled and broke my shoulder. So I went to the hospital and the nurse said, "What happened?" And I said, "I fell over." I didn't want to explain all of that to her. So she slides something on my wrist and I look down and it says fall risk.
Yeah.
And I'm like, don't worry, I'm not a fall risk. Right. But she's gone. But those two words haunted me. And I thought, yeah, I'm not a fall risk, I'm a worker. So I also had this uneasy sense of my place in the world, my purpose. And I thought, this is really interesting that our lives, me and the castle owner, are colliding just when we both have a weird dysfunctional relationship with purpose, and so do an awful lot of men and women across society.
I mean this is more about men because in a fascinating way and in a deeply reported way, as you know, is one of your signatures, it's not about the manosphere per se, but it is about the kind of, you were talking about, like a loss of purpose or a sense of aimlessness that seems to be widely shared or pervasive among a lot of younger men, although most of the men you're talking about are a little bit older. Like they're either like Chris Mark, who is what,
early
in his 60s.
Yeah.
Or your Graham Linehan, who we'll talk about in a little bit, who's got to be in his 50s,
I guess. Roughly the same age as me. Greg Chisholm, another star of the book, is this man called Greg Chisholm. I think I uncovered with Greg Chisholm the most extraordinary story that has ever unfolded on YouTube.
Ooh.
Because one of the things I look at in this book is what's filling the gap.
Yeah.
And YouTube came along as this kind of wide open country where a man could thrive through grit and perseverance as a content creator. So a lot of these like aimless men gravitated to. And I wasn't interested in the manosphere. In fact, my first rule, whenever I start a big project, I always think, what's the worst version of this story? And for me, the worst version of this is the manosphere and incels. I thought, if I write about them as little as possible, and it's a bit about them, but really not very much.
Well, and it's more that the manosphere may be filling, and the manosphere may be filling a void for some young men.
Yeah.
Or I actually think, I mean, you're wise to avoid it because in many ways it's kind of more of a media creation than a lived reality.
Yeah.
But let's talk, you know, somebody like Chris Mark, he wants to be Hugh Hefner. And you have a lot of interesting stuff about how even by the end of his life, Hugh Hefner was not Hugh Hefner.
No.
So, you know, but Mark also, unlike somebody like Hugh Hefner, who started Playboy in what, like 1955 or thereabouts. I remember Playboy and National Review kind of came out around the same time. And that's kind of an interesting pairing because they each radically transformed America and kind of publishing. But at least Hefner created something.
Yeah.
You know, and whereas Chris Mark has always been lacking purpose in his life.
Yeah. I mean, the castle, he managed to build Yeah. An unbelievable castle.
Yeah. And it is, you can go online, there's, because it's there for, bar mitzvahs and weddings and things like that.
Although actually they couldn't get a permit for weddings.
Oh, so they, okay.
Yeah, because in Connecticut, you have, for zoning variants for a business, it can't be too tall a building. So it made me laugh that the thing that would have made the weddings most magical, these towers and turrets, were the plans undoing because they went over the 35 meter or whatever, height minimum. So actually, he built the... I equate his castle as being a little bit like America in Iraq. Like he managed to build the castle, but then he didn't know how to get out, like what to do with it, how to recoup the vast construction costs.
Talk a bit about him psychologically, and then we'll leave him and we'll go through some of the other unraveling men that you discuss at length. But he, he seemed to suffer from manic depression or bipolar, and he had been kind of aimless in his life, partly because he was the, he had inherited a lot of wealth, like he didn't have to do anything. So he tried to do everything.
Yeah. He said to me that the second time we met, because I went to the castle and it was a little awkward. He ended up sending me death threats. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't sign an NDA. Mm-hmm. He had two murderers on his payroll called Carlos and Brandon, who were going to come and get me if I ever wrote negatively about the castle. Yeah. But I persevered. we got through that.
Yeah.
And in fact, he apologized for sending me those death threats. And in fact, he said, if you take Carlos and Brandon out for dinner, I'll Venmo you the money.
Yeah.
Where was I going with that?
So, about Chris's kind of psychological.
Yeah. So then I met him again in Fort Lauderdale a second time. And he said that 101 Princesses coincided with his daughter's growing up and leaving home.
Yeah.
And he did have purpose. He was feeding his daughters, he was educating them, but he suffered, he said, from terrible emptiness syndrome when they left. And so he wanted to fill his castle with women the same age as his
daughters. That were sexually available to him.
I mean, he wouldn't admit that to me, but I did so much digging, I had to.
Yeah.
And clearly there was a big sexual
element to
this.
And I guess this is a, he is representative of something. Mm. What is he representative of for you, do you think?
Well, I mean, Chris Mark is a more extreme example. Like the complexities of luring women to your castle in the post-Me Too age doesn't on the surface seem like a very relatable thing.
Right.
I was going to call the book The Impossibility of Keeping a Harem. How do you call it?
Harem.
In Britain, we say harem.
Yeah.
The Impossibility of Keeping a Harem in the post-Me Too age. But I changed it to the castle.
But it also intersects with, you talk about how in Gen Z is something like 40% of Gen Z. You have a data point in the book, 40% of Gen Z and like 20% of men, male boy Gen Z, adult Gen Z, men, want to be influencers. So there's this bizarre thread that also lives through this, where these, almost all of them, the people you talk about, are living their lives out in public somehow.
Yes, and as indeed they were in the castle too. There was a TikTok account. I don't think it's really there anymore, but
I looked at it not too long ago, and I think it was had not been updated in a while. That's why I was thinking about. And it was his daughter actually appearing in it.
I think they couldn't get insurance for the castle, and I think that's why they stopped doing the TikToks, because the TikToks had people doing like circus tricks and weird stuff, and so that's why. But it had like 800,000 followers on TikTok.
But he is just kind of devoid. Like he's a man out of time, and he's
unmoored,
running out of steam.
Yeah, rattling around his castle. The kind of man that he is very out of vogue. Mm-hmm. And it made me think, you know what, his story is kind of an outlier in many ways. Mm-hmm. But lots of men feel the same kind of thing that he's feeling. And I'm thinking about much more sympathetic men, people who used to drive structure and purpose from factory life and office life. And now all of those old structures are eroding. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, people feel unmoored. Durkheim called it anime. When society's rules abruptly change, it turns people haywire.
And it's fascinating, for me, when I read stories like this, and especially somebody like Chris Markin, you know, I'm in my early 60s, but the idea, like the one thing he won't contemplate is changing himself. Mm. He will try to rule the world, but he won't just become more interesting. I mean, or any, you know, he won't change anything. And I always think of, we are definitely in an age of, you know, just in, you know, the past 30 or 40 years, rapid transformation of society, of the economy, of culture, of gender roles and, you know, sexual orientation. Everything is up for grabs. And mostly, you know, one way you can look at that is like, this is incredibly liberating, you know, but the people that you focus on seem to have trouble to kind of evolve.
I mean, in many cases, when it comes to, for instance, becoming an institution of one, a personal brand on YouTube, it can be very liberating. I mean, I, you know, I'm sure like you, I hated gatekeepers. I came out, banging on people's doors. I was just like awkward, lower middle class.
Well, what had they ever done for me?
Right.
Right. You know, in 1994 or something.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, I got through, but it took me years.
Well, now you're part of the problem.
Right. I mean, I don't see myself.
You're a number one UK author. You've been consumed, or you've been subsumed into the board.
Right. Well, if that is part
you're
of the problem, give me the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
But I felt exactly the same way you do about gatekeepers. And so there is something definitely compelling about living in a post-gatekeeper world. I'm entirely in favor of that. But then when you try it out on YouTube, sometimes it works amazingly until it suddenly stops working.
Right. Well, that's a good point to start talking about Greg Chisholm, who you mentioned, who became a YouTube star. Explain who he is, and then, you know, what this is also, the back eye, but where Dionysius gets destroyed by the very women that he, you know, exhorts to mania.
Right.
But who is Greg Chisholm, and why is he important?
Yeah. So Greg, I mean, this is, just an unbelievable story. I ferreted out. Greg comes from a factory town that's completely fallen apart, Granite City, Illinois. He was destined to work in the factory that his father worked in, but he moved to Mexico. No prospects. Then his life gets even worse. At the age of 17, he collapses unconscious, has to have multiple open heart surgeries, ends up owing the health insurance companies $200,000 at 18 in this dying Rust Belt town. Yeah. Then he gets married. She leaves him with two daughters under the age of two. Right. So this couldn't be worse. Yeah. But then one day he's on YouTube and he sees a YouTuber called Durian Rider, a fruitarian cyclist, only eats fruit, gives a impassioned monologue about, you know, look at me, I'm cycling. Yeah. I used to be in prison, I lived on the street, but look at me now, I'm cycling through Australia. I'm putting on his Australian accent I want to temper that.
Yes, thank you.
Make a YouTube video, say, what's your story? You've got a story, what's your story? Yeah. And Greg, this was Greg's Damascus moment.
Right.
So he becomes an adult braces influencer, gets his teeth fixed, takes out a line of credit, that does well. But then while he's doing all of these videos with his adult braces journey, people are commenting, how come you've got lawnmowers behind you? Mm-hmm. And he said, bro, I do lawn care. And I say, dude, you do lawn care, do a lawn care vlog. Yeah. And he's going, dude, nobody wants to see a lawn care vlog.
Yeah.
They go, do a lawn care vlog. So he does a day in the life of a lawn care provider, and he becomes the lawn care goat. I think maybe the world's first and greatest YouTube lawn care influencer. Yeah. Goes to a lawn care convention in Kentucky, and it's like Rihanna showed up.
Yeah.
People throwing their lawn care t-shirts at him so he can wear them in his videos. So things are going so well for Greg. And that's just then things get unbelievably better before they fall off a cliff and couldn't get more worse.
Yeah, why do they get worse?
Well, he starts to bring his daughters into the videos in a completely nice, utopian, innocent way.
Yeah.
Sweet girls. Because one of these videos that he made with his daughters, unboxing Barbie cruise ship, was never meant to be like a brand.
Right.
He was just putting them on his personal YouTube channel, which nobody watched. Right. But then one day, they do an unboxing Barbie cruise ship video and it gets like 10 million views completely randomly. His daughters are very sweet on camera, very watchable, and it's you know, kids love it. So then he gets a call from YouTube saying, this is amazing. We're starting a school, YouTube school. Mm-hmm. Learn how to make more videos like that. So he does everything that YouTube tells him to do. And as a consequence, his videos with his daughters get weirder and weirder. Yeah. What I love about this story is that he's a really good-hearted, good person. Mm-hmm. Yet he makes a series of decisions, all of which make total sense.
Right.
However, like the frog in slowly boiling water, mm-hmm. it's getting weirder and weirder. Yeah. And he had 13 billion views in 2016 and 2017 for the series that he did called Bad Baby, mm-hmm. where they all dressed up as babies. And that's when things start to go horrifically wrong.
Hey, Reason Interview listeners, you know that AI is coming for your job, but can you compete? Reliance College invites students and young professionals to AI-proof you. A program built to develop the skills no algorithm can automate. AI can generate answers and automate tasks, but it can't replace human judgment, responsibility, or leadership. AIProfU trains exactly those capacities through deep Socratic analysis of great texts. Over 10 weeks, you'll start with a 3-day intensive session in Chicago. Continue with 6 online seminars drawing on Aristotle, Adam Smith, and Ayn Rand, and finish with an in-person capstone presenting your own work. This isn't a coding boot camp. As one investment banker on the advisory panel put it, judgment is not going out of style. The next cohort begins October 2nd. Discover the education built for you in the age of AI. Visit reliancecollege.org/AI. That's reliancecollege.org/AI, or check the show notes. And now back to the Reason interview.
Again, I mean, one of the things that's fascinating in his story is he is somebody who evolves. He's shit out of luck, out of work, et cetera. And then he builds something new and then it explodes.
Yes.
And we don't need to go into exactly why, but
But actually answers your gatekeeper question in a way, because YouTube always, I don't know if it represented itself, but it certainly got the reputation as being this kind of gatekeeper-free utopia.
Right.
But as soon as shit hit the fan with Greg and his videos that they encouraged him to make, a hierarchy suddenly magically manifests.
This is always the problem with, you know, with liberation kind of rhetoric, right? Or liberation movements. Do they want to replace all hierarchies or do they merely want to be the new pharaohs, right? You know, and it's unclear. A kind of tension in the book. Let's talk about Graham Linehan, because he's another man who is unraveling, and he's somebody who you were very friendly with. You talk about how you guys were part of the skeptics movement in the UK or in England, in Britain. What was that, in the 90s mostly?
Or early 2000s? Early 2000s, I joined the movement for purely solipsistic reasons. Mm-hmm. My first book then came out, and I was like traipsing around the country trying to get people interested, and no one was interested. I did a talk actually for my second book, The Many Snake Goats. I gave a talk in Birmingham in the UK, and 4 people showed up. And during the Q&A, one of them said, I don't know why you seem so annoyed with us. We're the ones who came.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you always hate the people who are in front of you, right? I love when I've been to a lot of concerts and events where, you know, the host or the performer will berate the audience for being there because they're not the people he really wants.
But, I know, right? So in the midst of this, I turn up at this thing called Skeptics in the pub, and it's packed.
Yeah.
And people, and I walk into people going, there he is, Mr. Johnson. And I thought, well, I found my people.
Yeah, that's right.
Who are my people?
Yeah.
And I said, so what? You meet once a week at a pub and you're skeptical? Yeah. And they go, yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, isn't that a weird way to live your life? So they all went, no.
Yeah.
And so, and
it was fun, right? Oh, it was a nice community.
I got some great stories from there. I really enjoyed going. I went every, it's probably the only time I've ever been a member of a club.
Yeah.
I got some great stories from it. I did a, I went on a Sylvia Brown psychic cruise to interview her, and practically got thrown off the cruise. I would never have found that story if I hadn't been in Skeptics.
Well, and so Graham Linehan, who's arguably best known as the creator or co-creator of Father Ted,
and the IT Crowd,
both of which I'm more of a fan of the IT Crowd because I was raised Catholic. Anything with Father in the title is like, I can't watch it.
In Britain, we call it a busman's holiday. Like, you don't have fun doing the thing, don't
but,
you?
He was a beloved, TV creator, very funny. And then on the IT Crowd, which is a great show, which is widely available, he had an episode where the main character is played by one of the main characters, Matthew Berry, ends up dating a trans woman.
Yeah.
So it's somebody who was born a man who becomes a woman, and he doesn't understand that until the very end.
Yeah,
and then hilarity ensues.
Yeah, she says, I'm having a wonderful time with you. There's something I need to tell you. I used to be a man.
Yeah.
And he says, I don't care.
Yeah.
And what you realize later is that he mishears and thinks she said, I used to live in Iran.
Right.
The joke, as Graham himself acknowledges, would have been better if she said, oh man, and not Iran.
Yes.
That was
But it's, it's interesting because you can, that episode, which came out, around 2008 or so?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. It aired without, I mean, it's pretty funny. You can track it down. It's pulled from the regular release of the IT Crowd, but it's widely available. Mm. And it's really not offensive in any meaningful way. And as Graham Linehan, a couple of people were like, I don't know about this. He was like, the joke is on Matthew Berry's character because he's an idiot and the person is very nice and slugs him and everything. But then you track how, if Graham Linehan is known for anything now, it is for being a rabid, outspoken, anti-trans activist or, Twitter presence.
It also has started, by the way, I can't remember for the life of me, because my chapter on Graham was twice as long as it ended up being. I thought it was outstaying its welcome. It was also a very stressful chapter for me to write because of the way that I'd been brought into the story. But the moment he decided to, quote unquote, dive into this was when he was recovering in hospital from testicular cancer.
Right.
He had nothing on. So again, just like me, because I should say I went to the castle because I was just out of hospital and I felt that life was passing me by. Yeah. I didn't want to be a fool.
Even though, and you described the pain just in driving, even in like a modern car, through upstate New York and Western Connecticut, it was painful.
Absolutely, yeah. And I turned up at the castle, his guard dog, Cerberus, named after the multi-headed hound that guards the gates of Hades, lunges at me.
Right.
I kind of try and get away from it, rip at my surgery scar, and let out a shriek.
Graham is like this too, though. I mean, there were multiple issues going on with him, particularly the cancer.
Yeah.
And testicular cancer. I mean, do you want to psychologize him and say, like, is it, if he had had lung cancer, would he not care so much about transsexual elements, or is it like it's his testicles?
I don't know. That's too. I don't know.
Yeah.
I do not know. But what I do know is that it was that period of enforced relaxation that clearly he was kind of feeling the same thing that I was, and going to the castle, I presume he was feeling something like that.
Yeah.
I think it's no coincidence that it started during this moment of enforced relaxation.
And it's fascinating because his original responses to people criticizing, that particular trans episode of the IT Crowd, he engaged them. It was like, some of the humor was off color, not as good as it should be, but I didn't mean any harm. And then within a few years, really, he's the most outspoken person on Twitter who...
And I really wanted to... A kind of beat in the book that I really wanted to hit was, I'm sure you've noticed, a sort of huge wave of disinhibited behavior sweeping the world, of people just like ripping off their faces and just allowing their ids to run wild. Yeah. And I thought that was a really important thing for me to write about.
Is that particularly men, or is it just that when men do it, it takes on a particular form?
I definitely see it with women too. In fact, there was that terrible incident at that play park in Minnesota, yeah. Right, when the woman
was scraping a racial epithet
at a little tiny 8-year-old autistic boy, who really was, by the way, the anti-woke brigade saying, there's no proof that he was autistic, no proof he was 8.
Well, he's self-diagnosed.
But we did our digging, and he is autistic, and he was 8 years old. So she was another example of somebody just ripped off her face. And some of this is a response to the excesses of what became known as cancel culture, I think. This idea of people hated just walking around feeling scared that they'd say the wrong thing. Yeah, we remember like around 2017, just after my book, I wrote the first book about this topic.
Yes. So You've Been Publicly Shamed.
Yeah. And people were walking around scared. And that's an untenable thing.
Right.
I remember saying to people, you know, people would like yell at me when that book came out. Public shaming is one of the few weapons of the dispossessed. Yep. And my reply would be like, people really hate being told what to do.
Right.
Like, this isn't going to work.
Yeah.
And clearly...
you always create the monsters that you are seeking to extirpate or something like that.
Yeah.
Right? Where...
So exactly. So I think part of the reason is like a pendulum swing back from people being terrified of being shamed to deciding to become unashamed. Right.
You think I'm a monster. I will show you.
Yeah.
You know what I really am, which kind of is the worst version of what a critic might say.
Yeah. At first, it's an interesting around 2015, 2016, people were sort of putting their toe in the water of unashamedness. Max Mosley, it's an incredible story. I don't know if I've got time to tell.
Please.
Okay, so Max Mosley's in my public shaming book, and this definitely gets back to Graham. I'm not avoiding it. Max Mosley was the son of Oswald Mosley, the fascist leader. He had a much better life. He had a much more kind of Ralph Nader type life. He was involved in car safety and so on. But one day...
So a true Nazi.
Right. Yeah. For wanting seat belts in the car, only in libertarian.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
One day he goes to the newsstand, front page of the News of the World is fascist leader's son and sick Nazi orgy. And Max, and there's a photo, a grainy photo of Max being whipped by a woman in German uniform. Mm-hmm. And so at first, of course, Max was bereft.
Yeah.
But then he thought, you know what? The News of the World has made a terrible error here. The orgy was definitely German army themed, but there were no swastikas.
Right.
So he sues the News of the World, forces them to find the evidence of Nazism. There was none.
Yeah.
Wins the case and becomes a sort of hero to the sex positive left. Yeah. Like people, Max Mosley was never a particularly likable guy, like a son of Oswald Mosley. Suddenly becomes like this hero across the board.
Right. Yeah.
And he said to me, I said to him, how did you do it? Like all of these other people are just collapsing.
Yeah.
And he said, I need to think about this. And he went off and came back, emailed me and said, I think I've got it. A shaming is a pact between a shamer and a shamee. Right. And if the shamee steps out of the pact by refusing to feel ashamed, then the whole thing crumbles.
Yeah.
And I think Max was a very, very early example of that.
Yeah, it's in an American context. And I want to come back to Linehan and the book, The Castle. But, Bill Clinton in the late 90s, as his sex scandals started to kind of become public and multiply, the conventional wisdom in the media and certainly in D.C. was like, you have to step down. Mm. You should be ashamed of yourself, et cetera. And Clinton was just kind of like, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
And he waited everybody out. And by the time he left office in early 2001, he was beloved, really, even almost by Monica Lewinsky.
Right.
And then that is an early kind of premonition of Donald Trump, who is clearly beyond shame. And that is both powerful and terrifying.
Yes, absolutely.
In a world leader, and it's obviously different in... world leaders than in everyday people.
But it is you get it. Like if we overuse shame as a weapon, transgressors are going to become like hospital superbugs.
Yeah,
like
and also it is like, there's one thing, at the character kind of at the center of your book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, was the publicist,
Justine Sacco.
Yeah, Justine Sacco, who really did not deserve to have her life destroyed for what she did. And that happens all the time, is that suddenly people are using kind of nuclear weapons to to blow apart trivial offenses.
And that's what I was focusing on. And so you've been publicly shamed. I decided I wanted to write a book about private individuals being disproportionately punished for some minor transgression.
Right.
Justine totally fits into that.
But then, you know, to bring it back to, let's say, Linehan at this moment, his world is unraveling. And as he became more and more outspoken about trans issues and being anti-trans, he lost his wife, his family, all of his work dried up because nobody wanted to work with him. And we can, you know, argue whether that's good or bad, but that's just the reality of it.
I mean, certainly some people would say it's the way that he expressed his views, which is what they found most difficult. So I think in Graham's case, so this is the reason why I wanted to put him in the book, is because it felt like he was a really extraordinary example of unashamedness mutating to the next level of disinhibition, of him just deciding to like rip off his face. Mm-hmm. And is it? It's partly a response to the excesses of public shaming, but I think,
and of wokeness of what we're now calling woke one.
And I heard that phrase just the other day. I think we all heard that phrase just the other day
when AOC invented it and wrote off. It was crazy. That's right.
So I think that's part of it. But the other thing I was interested in was, you know, the wider theme in my book is what happens to people's inner lives when structures collapse.
Right.
And I wonder, I kind of postulate in the book as to whether Graham was also suffering from a form of what Durkheim called anomie.
Yes.
Like his life has completely changed.
Right.
Like Greg Chisholm's factory closing down, the mainstream media, his world, the entertainment world, was suddenly criticizing him.
Yeah.
And he felt like, you know, cut adrift.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say that he, you know, laid most of the dynamite himself.
Right.
But nonetheless, that was the situation that he was in.
Yeah.
And his disinhibited behavior was a kind of response to that. I equated, actually, there's a story of it in the book briefly of a young girl called Brandy Bragg, whose lovely girl, West Virginia, 15 years old, I think. Her grandfather wins $300 million on the lottery, and it ruins them. Within a year, she's in the back of a car, her chauffeur's driving her around, smoking crack, banknotes flying out the window.
Yeah.
And because nothing means anything anymore.
Right.
And I equate Graham's insults towards me, because I was brought into it through a mistake of my own.
Yeah.
One night in 2019, I was asleep again.
You should never go to sleep, John.
Never
Ronson,
sleep again. Just before I fell asleep, somebody said, "Why does John Ronson still follow you on Twitter?"
Yeah.
And as I woke up, I saw Graham's response, which was, "Because John Ronson thinks you're all assholes."
Yeah.
And my one mistake in this, I think, was I tweeted, and I shouldn't have done it. I just tweeted to him, "Graham, I don't think your critics are assholes. I think you've been acting like a bully." And that's when the gates of hell opened. And I stayed silent for years, like 8 years, pretty much. And he was like throwing insult, like sometimes 50 a day, probably thousands by now. And I equate that to banknotes flying out of Brandy Bragg's car window. Like, they mean more to me than they do to him, I think. And nothing means anything anymore in his life. So we might as well just rip off his face and just allow that. That's sort of...
I'm curious if, one of the things I was thinking about when I was reading this book, and particularly because I assumed it was going to be more about younger men who, and you talk with Richard Reeve, briefly, who wrote a fantastic book called Of Boys and Men. I've talked to him. We have a mutual admiration society. Mm. And he's really called attention to the ways in which a lot of younger men and boys are falling behind, and academically, career-wise, et cetera. Mm. But this book is not really about them. And I'm wondering if, in a way, the world you're describing is Brandy Bragg. She's an extreme version of it. But compared to our most of us, our parents, but certainly our grandparents or great-grandparents, we are driving around in a limousine. Like, none of us has to work as hard as our grandparents did.
Yeah.
We have all of these material comforts. And the one thing that we don't have is meaning. And, and this is the thing that all of the good people fought for over the past 100 years. Like, you don't have to believe in God. You don't have to, be heterosexual or homosexual. You don't have to work in the whatever job your parents had, et cetera, and that lack of meaning, we need meaning in our lives, but we have to create it ourselves.
Yes.
And we have not been educated in a way to do that, or we don't know how to do that, because those of us who are under, I don't know, you know, maybe 70, we're the first humans on Earth where you get to choose what boulder you're going to roll up the hill every day.
Yeah. Right? Yes. 39% of Americans apparently now identify as content creators. This is huge change.
So that also then adds something, because content is for public consumption.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a real question, and I think this recurs, the interiority, the psychological interiority or complexity of the people you're talking about is really up for grabs.
Yes. I think that everything you just said, you just put it so beautifully. I did speak to Richard Reeves. He said to me, I like him very much.
And
too.
Like you, he had to leave England in order to have a living.
Right.
Right.
Right. He said to me, there's 6.7 million men in America. It's much more now. It's like more than 7 million who aren't only unemployed, they aren't even looking for work.
Right.
They've just bowed out of society. And he said, those are the people you should be. These are the ones. Everybody focuses on the men who are lashing out. I'm much more interested in the ones who are shutting down.
Right.
And I was very inspired by him saying that. And so I wanted to tell stories about recluses, men and boys who've just like dropped out, and what's that doing? Because, for me, a day without purpose is unbelievably bleak. So a lifetime without purpose, what's that doing to them and to their loved ones? And I go down that road a little bit. Mm-hmm. It turns out that my castle owner, Chris Marks' great grandfather, Clayton, built a utopian worker town, which is now full of recluses. Yeah. In 100 years, it's gone from vibrant to useless. And
this is in northwestern Indiana.
It's East Chicago, Indiana. Marktown. It's kind of an incredible place. Yeah. It's because it was based off of an English country village, like a Miss Marple mystery type village.
Right.
Yet it's completely surrounded by plants and factories and so on. So it's an amazing story, actually. Yeah. But it's actually not easy to tell stories about recluses, because I had exactly the same problem.
And you interview the guy who runs the town's museum.
Yeah.
Who is very conflicted.
I don't want to make a big deal out of this. This is a small deal, but I did notice at one point he was like concentrating his ire not on the billionaires who ruined his town, but on some local woman in authority who wouldn't clean up the rust. So I thought that was an interesting. Like I say, Paul's he's a good guy, but I did think that was interesting microcosm of how the culture wars have become like the opium for the people while they're billionaires.
Well, it's always interesting. I was thinking about this because for a variety of reasons, I was revisiting One Floor Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the Ken Kesey novel, which was made, the Milos Forman movie from the mid-70s with Jack Nicholson, where, particularly when it was written, it's a critique of society, and somehow that it's women who are calling all the shots. Against the vital, life affirming statutory rapist McMurphy.
Wow.
And it's kind
I
of
forgot.
Like
is that that's what he was
yeah,
in for?
That's,
in the movie. Yeah. Does it say that?
In the movie I'm not sure, but it's in any case it's kind of fascinating. So there are reasons, women are increasingly, in charge of elements of society. So it's different now than it was in 1962.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating that's, men, when they feel displaced, it's, because women have taken over.
Yeah.
And this
when
is
it's a, clearly,
it's much more complex than that. Because if I have one critique of some of the motifs in your book, is the deindustrialization of America is a half century, more than a half century long. I went to grad school in Buffalo, and so people in the early 90s, and people were like, oh, it was great until the factory jobs left yesterday. And it was like, they left in 1950.
Yeah.
That's
a fair point. I guess for me, that was like the start of it. But also maybe the kind of collapse of the factory towns and the factories, it almost becomes like a metaphor for subsequent collapses.
I agree with that. And again, that idea of what do you do for purpose when you are suddenly the thing that was dominating your life, the structures are gone. And, you know, it can either be like, oh, we're free, we can do whatever we want, or I have no direction in my life. I want to bring up Andrew Gold, who is one of the characters you talk about, who's a YouTuber and a podcaster who has a show, I believe it's called Heretics. And he is somebody
and a nice guy, by the
way. No, I've interacted briefly with him, and you talk about how you were going to blurb a book for him, and in between the time that you wrote the blurb and when the book was coming out, you felt that his content had changed in a way that is representative of a larger thing. But he represents somebody, he's in his late 30s. He's a young man who is finding purpose by engaging in kind of culture war motifs. Explain how he fits into the book, or you know, is he re-raveling his world, or is he more a symptom of the unraveling?
I think he's a very intriguing mix of the two, actually. I'm really glad you brought him up, because he's a small part of the book, but I think it's a really important moment in the book. So again, a bit like Graham and a bit like, you know, the whole Castle story, this is a personal story that came to me.
Right.
Andrew, I'd been a guest on his show, what it was called, On the Edge, I think. Back then, his titles were things like the BBC's first blind presenter and her lovely dog, which got, I think, 425 views. And then Amanda Knox's surprising favourite Harry Potter book got 69 views. So
I'm assuming it was Prisoner of Azkaban.
Well, I'm wondering, what... Yeah. I guess it would be. You're right. Okay, I guess that's the surprising... But then, he, you know, he had the odd breakout hit, like Charles Manson and Scientology or something like that, 300,000 views. But by the time I blurbed his book. And I got to say, like, I'm throwing this out there. People may think I'm an asshole for this. By the time, you know, I was like watching his output change dramatically. So it was no longer those videos, it was things like wokeness is the most evil thing you can do, or the genetic defect of wokeness, or civil war is coming, many of us will die. And these are getting like hundreds
of
thousands.
I have to watch
views.
that.
And you know, as I wrote about in So You've Been Publicly Shamed, you know, I have my definitely have my problems with some of the tactics that the progressive left was doing at that time. Like, I thought it was like a really big mistake. But I am not a fan of videos called wokeness is the most evil thing you can do. And also, my whole thing is being against that. Like I make these shows like Things Fell Apart, which are humanist, non-ideological, curious shows about people. That's what I do. So I was just sitting there thinking, you know, I've blurred this guy's book, and now the stuff that he does is like the polar opposite of what I do. I'm not trying to prod.
And it is complicated by the fact that he has talked about how he was trying to follow in your footsteps, and people like Louis Theroux, and you talk about how you and Louis Theroux kind of came up at the same time in a system. That's what Andrew Gold want. You know, he would be a younger version of you.
And I think it is true. Well, I look at actually. Well, let me, so I called him up and I said, "Look, Andrew, look, I feel very. You know, I sort of. You know, you can imagine what I was like on the phone. Yeah. Like, you know, and then like that for 45 minutes. And he said, "No, I completely get it." He said, "My friends have been saying the same thing to me that that they think I've changed." That I've lurched into this extreme content. And he said, and the worst thing of all is that I don't even mean it. So my blurb was taken off the jacket. But that line, I don't even mean it, really stayed with me. So I asked if I could interview him for the book to talk about that, like his arc from how did he go from that. And it's definitely true that his white maleness, which would have been a boom pretty much any other time, it suddenly wasn't. It suddenly become a problem for him. But also, I think what he was doing was taking that and molding the truth into a new kind of victim narrative that wasn't completely accurate. I'll give you one example. He said that he went to like 50 or 100 meetings, and every one of them said, something along the lines of, well, we can't give you a job, you're too much like Louis Theroux, which he took as code for white man. So I asked to talk to some of the, you know, if he could put me in touch with some of the people who turned him down for being a white man. And the only person he put me in touch with was a producer from Vice, sent me an email that he'd pitched Vice a story about a woman who throws dolls at women who are walking into abortion clinics. And the Vice journalist replied, look, this is a really interesting story, but it feels a bit uncomfortable because it's such a feminine story. Would you be up for producing it and having one of our female talent on screen? And Andrew said, well, you know, that's kind of reasonable. So he couldn't really back up this stuff. But he did a course called How to Master YouTube. And the course said the way to master YouTube is to create opposition and conflict. So that's what he was doing. So I tell his story. So it's a bit of both. Like, when you don't really mean it. So yes, he's making a better living on YouTube now. He's now making money. When you get the nuanced idiots like me, he loses money. When you get wokeness is the most evil thing in the world, he makes like a couple of £1,000 a week or whatever. So sure, but at the same time, he's building his house on sand. He doesn't even mean it.
Do you feel like, you know, there's, to kind of put it in Marxian terms, which I think, you know, makes sense, you know, where there's an economic base that gives rise to a cultural superstructure, right? This is, so, you know, when the economic base, if it's industrialization or whatever we want to talk about, that goes away. And then the culture that arises from, you know, that kind of disruption is screwed up. But is, you know, on the other, in the other direction is, are things like YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, where you have to, you know, you're pushing your personality or profile out into the public. Are those building, are those very strong incentives for people to become more polarized, less nuanced? Or is it a way of gaining, you know, an audience that could actually be very interested in long form, interesting, nuanced texts?
Well, actually, Andrew, partly because I yelled at him because he brought out a blog post where he said that I'd, in taking my name off his book, I'd committed a contemptible act of cancellation. So I phoned him up and
You are the worst, you're woke, you're part of the worst evil ever.
So I said, me taking my name off his book wasn't a contemptible act of cancellation. It was because he'd lurched into this extreme content and he should take some personal responsibility rather than just blame everybody else for everything. So that's what I said. And I think I got through to him a bit because he did start to push back against people more in interviews after that. So yeah, if he, it's kind of possible that, and I'm, and if that's the case, and if I helped that, then I'm delighted because all I want is people having curious, interesting conversation.
And certainly your, I mean, your work is exquisitely, even painfully nuanced and reported and things like that. I mean, you have your, you know, presumptions and things like that, but obviously you're doing well. Do you think it's possible for somebody, whether male or female, you know, who, you know, are 25 or 30 now, like, is that also possible, or are we in this world, you know, a Hobbesian media world of, you know, you got to dress up like an adult baby, or you have to call everybody an Islamofascist, or, you know, a right winger or left winger or something?
I know people still do get through, I think, in interesting ways. There's that, I can think of, you know, a few. I'm slightly out of my depth here because I haven't watched that many of them, but ContraPoints, I think, is an interesting example of somebody who does kind of, you know, nuanced, interesting stuff often. You know, you don't always have
Seems to have faded a little bit. Although, you know, this for me, I mean, I never know why my feed, like, does my feed change because I'm watching different things or, you know, people, I'm sure in the old world of print magazines, I would do this where I would love a magazine for 3 or 4 years. And then you realize you've gone through all of the stories it tells and then it starts retelling them. So you kind of move on.
Well, actually, so here's my answer to that. So, so right now, the two most successful, thank goodness, nonfiction books in Britain are me and Patrick Radden Keefe. And, you know, his book, London Falling.
Okay.
Pat, I don't know, in Britain...
I don't know anything. What is London Falling?
Oh, well, Patrick's, like, in Britain, he's a phenomenon, but he's very successful here, too. He writes for The New Yorker. London Falling, actually, some thematic similarities with The Castle, with my book. It's about a kid, a Jewish kid in North London, like 19 years old, who dies mysteriously. Mm-hmm. He falls or jumps or push or is pushed from a very fancy apartment building mm-hmm. in West London into the Thames. And when his parents start to investigate like what happened, what they discover was that he was leading a double life mm. where he was telling everybody that he was actually the son of Russian oligarchs. Yeah. Because I think at his school in North London, there was like a lot of sons of Russian oligarchs yeah. at the school. Mm-hmm. So he, in this fantasy world, recreating himself in a mm-hmm. sort of weird way,
yeah.
gets somehow involved in the London underworld. Mm. Who think he's the son of a Russian oligarch, and that's the story that Patrick tells. But what me and Patrick have in common is that we both do sort of narrative nonfiction.
Right.
They're kind of page turners, they're not yeah. polemics, and they're nuanced and thoughtful. Mm-hmm. And they're the two most, right, as we speak, they're the two nonfiction books that yeah. are doing the best in Britain, which makes me think there's really an appetite for that stuff, yeah. both as readers, but also as other adventurers.
Right. As I don't want to say content creators, but mm-hmm. producers, right? Writers yeah. or journalists or adventurers and things like that. Mm-hmm. In the few minutes we have left, so how does the Chris Mark story end up? Because you go and meet him in Fort Lauderdale. At various points, he's in South America mm-hmm. with always, you know, kind of with different women who may be the princess, you know, the ultimate princess for him and things like that. But how do things end with him?
Well, can I give like one spoiler and then let yes. people read?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So. And I want to say, when I got the galleys for this book, we were not going to talk for like 2 months, but I was like, I'll just see if I like it. And then I was obsessed with it. I mean, there's, you know, this concept of ludic reading where you just start reading something and you're transported into a world. And I spent like 72 hours reading this book. Oh. So it's that kind of, you know, very addictive reading. And so it is a page turner, even if it is like deeply reported and analytical.
Well, I couldn't appreciate that more. Thank you. And so I'll tell you one spoiler. About a year yeah. and a half into me looking into Chris, the castle owner, I get a call. And it turns out that I'm not the only person investigating mm-hmm. him. He's being investigated by several agencies, the FBI, Department of Homeland Security.
Neither of which should exist, by the way. I just want to say that for the reason viewers out there.
Well, actually, let me say one thing. I'm going to say something in favor of the Department of Homeland Security yeah. right now. So because of me finding myself in this world, right. I started to learn a lot about Homeland Security investigations. Mm-hmm. And so they're like the sort of elite corner of that department. Yeah. And they do sex trafficking mm-hmm. and drug running and child pornography cases, cross-border crime. Mm. And just around the time that I was, you know, heading towards finishing the book, a decree came down that all of these Homeland Security investigators had to be pulled off these serious cases and instead had to assist ICE in their urban roundups.
Right.
And you can imagine, I mean, they hated that. Like, sure. you know, they said, you know, we're like homicide cops being pulled right. off investigations to do jaywalking.
Right.
So I think it's important. Well, this is the conclusion I came yeah. to, that in that whole mess of all of these people who suddenly storm into Minnesota,
right.
there's different people with different agendas.
Yeah.
And the Homeland Security people, the Homeland Security investigators, I think by and large, I can't
right.
certainly can't speak for all of them, but overwhelmingly, I think they yeah. really don't want to be there.
Right.
Yeah. So I discover that he's being investigated by all yeah. of those people, and then the story unravels even further.
Yeah. Tell us just briefly about the next season of Things Fell Apart. And, you know, the I think it was the second season that I interviewed about, which was about COVID mm. and kind of the way that COVID drove everybody nuts in yeah. different ways. And you pull out, you know, like one of the things that is great in both seasons is that you kind of find the beginning of an idea that could be decades prior to the story you're talking about, but it just percolates out and you realize like the insanity that we're experiencing at a given moment can be traced back to an earlier,
yeah.
You know, issue.
And a tiny little thing. You know. And often it's the smallest thing. Like in season one, I've got this like 17-year-old or 18-year-old kid who wants to make a showreel to impress Hollywood producers. Mm-hmm. And that ambition kickstarts the entire Christian evangelist anti-abortion movement.
Right.
And yeah. So it is, these tiny things yeah. have these enormous consequences. So season three, we're doing something a little bit different, I think, but I hope and think just as good. Mm-hmm. So I decided I didn't want to do the culture wars anymore.
Right.
I think I don't have, like, I hate X, but the one...
You mean Twitter?
Well, yeah, Twitter.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, the one, you know, one arguably positive thing that came from that was that though it sort of tempered down the culture wars a little bit because mm-hmm. the progressive left couldn't coalesce anymore and,
right.
and you know, overuse their power. They moved to blue sky where there right. isn't the same thing. And so it felt like the culture wars, not dying, but the culture wars becoming like less important in our, right. in our lives. And what was taking its place was David and Goliath stories, individuals mm-hmm. declaring war on institutions, mm-hmm. like Luigi Mangione,
yeah.
for instance. So the new season of Things Fell Apart are eight stories of that.
One Luigi Mangione?
No, annoyingly. Yeah. I knew the one I wanted to do. I wanted to do his book group in Hawaii.
Yeah.
They read the Unabomber's
right.
manifesto.
But then a bunch of kind of like, libertarian economist types, etc. I mean, it was very
yeah.
wide range. I mean, this is where I suspect that we're in an era, and this is a good thing, but it's going to be difficult to navigate, where all of the associations, the ideological and political associations we take for granted, don't make sense to people, you know, any more than there's a great novel by oh, geez, I am having a senior moment now. The new novel by James Ellroy.
Okay.
Where it's, you know, a lot of it's set in L.A. in the early 60s, and a lot of it revolves around which side were you on in the Spanish Civil War?
Right.
And I can you know, like, who cares now? But back then it mattered, and it was obvious if you were on this side, it meant X, all of these other associations, and those right. are just dying, right?
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I would have loved to have done a Luigi Mangione story,
yeah.
and that was kind of the inspiration for the series. Mm-hmm. But we've got eight stories mm-hmm. that I think are really great, mm-hmm. really great. They're about David's battling Goliaths in the political arena, mm-hmm. but also in people's personal lives.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a mental health one, which I absolutely love. I think yeah. I think it's one of the best things I've ever done.
Fantastic.
And
when is this out?
January.
Okay.
There's a Doge one as well, which I also absolutely
yeah.
love.
It is always amazing that David versus Goliath stories, and of course even invoking that now means that you are objectively pro-Israel and anti-Gaza, right? No, I mean, this is why people talk, but David versus Goliath stories, which are, you know, Hollywood is probably the greatest, you know, recurring example of that. And it, you know, whether you're on the right or the left or anywhere in between, people love that, right?
Yeah.
Because, absolutely.
Yeah. And obviously in the series, sometimes it's hard, sometimes you're on the side of the David, sometimes you're on the side of the Goliath.
Yeah.
Also, there's sometimes the Davids are on the left, sometimes they're on the right,
right.
sometimes they're anarchists.
Yeah.
So it's a very wide range. I'm really talking about it actually. Yeah. I feel very excited.
Well, it's exciting.
It.
We'll look for that in January. But in the meantime, the new book by John Ronson is The Castle: Adventures in a World of Unraveling Men. It's already a UK bestseller. So this is like your Beatles moment. You know, yeah. This is Ed Sullivan. You,
well,
right?
I'm not certain that America's a steeper hill to climb than Britain.
It always has been. Or maybe you'll be Cliff Richard, right? And you'll yeah. just really won't ever make a big year, which is obviously.
Or Robbie Williams, my friend.
Wrong, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Who you have an interesting story to tell about. But the book is The Castle. It's by John Ronson, my guest today. Thanks for watching.